Mr. Wallet, what, if anything, did you say or do?
I said, where's the gun? Where's the gun?
Was any of your brother officers there with you?
I'm not sure. I believe it might have been Kenny, but I'm not sure at that point.
Now, after you examined the wallet, what, if anything, did you do with the wallet?
At that point, when I realized it was not a weapon, I dropped it from my hand, started looking around to see if there, where the weapon was. I went on from his right side. I crossed over closer to the rear door, and I did a quick search of the area for the firearm.
And did you find one?
No.
What did you next do?
I think I said something like, I seen muzzle flash. I seen the muzzle flash. At that point, the individual was still moving on the floor, and he was breathing. I told him, don't die. Don't die. Keep breathing. I can hear Kenny Boss on the radio calling for an ambulance. I knew an ambulance was en route. Came a point where the individual stopped breathing. He stopped moving. At that point, I'm holding his hands. Keep breathing. I just went to check his vitals. I was going to give him CPR. Put my hands on his chest. I don't know if I pumped once. I don't even know if I pumped. I put my hands in the vicinity of his chest. Then I said, oh, God. Let me see how bad it is. If I start pumping on his chest, maybe I'm going to make it worse. At that point, I decided to lift up his shirt and to see if he was shot in the abdomen or just shot. I lifted up the shirt a few inches, and I observed two bullet holes. To his lower midsection. So, oh my God. I just held him, his hand. I rubbed his face. Please.
You believe that the poster that you had in the car that night?
This is probably one. This is possibly one that was up in the front, and I had other ones in the back.
Is that the one related to the rapist, the serial rapist?
This is one of at least two, if not three, composite sketches that were issued to the street crime unit in regards to this rape pattern.
Okay. Isn't it fair to say that Mr. Diallo did not look at all like the serial rapist? Other than he was a male black, approximately 130 to 150 pounds.
On this particular photograph of the one that you handed me, there is a minimal resemblance to Mr. Diallo.
Matter of fact, that would fit the description of numerous young males in the 4-3 precinct. Is that correct?
That I couldn't say.
You couldn't say that there are numerous young male blacks in the 4-3 precinct that would fit that description, 5'6 to 5'8, 130, 150 pounds?
I'm sure there are.
By the way, did you meet up with any supervisors that night?
The only supervisor that we arranged that evening was at muster, which was Lieutenant Pucci.
So you didn't see Lieutenant Cantwell during the course of the night?
No.
You didn't see Sergeant Patelli during the course of the night?
No.
Wasn't Sergeant Patelli at the Boynton Avenue job?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. My record, yes. Sergeant Patelli was at the Boynton Avenue job. And possibly one of the other supervisors that I didn't recognize or don't recall seeing.
You're saying the man was looking up and down the street, is that correct?
Yes.
And looking up and down the street isn't a crime, is it, officer?
Absolutely not.
Do you know of any people that come home from a hard day's work and stay out in front of their house or on their porches and look up and down the block to see what's going on? Do you, sir?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
If we have a red back.
Your knowledge on grounds of irrelevant is irrelevant.
So say, well, would you agree that Mr. Diallo was situated in the position where there was more light than where you and Officer McMillan were standing?
I'd say that's fair, yeah.
That's fair?
Sure.
You're out in the dark, right?
There are street lamps that are out in the street.
Right. Aside from the street lamps, you're out on the street in whatever light's on the street.
Sure. And you had the light from 1159 glaring out the door to it.
And Mr. Diallo is by the vestibule wherein there is a light. Is that fair to say?
Well, like I said before, sir, the lighting conditions in this picture, as far as I recollect, are not properly depicted. And that the outside light, I'm almost positive, was off. And if there was an inside light on, it was very dim.
Were you able to make out Mr. Diallo's features from where you were standing and looking in?
At that point, it only looked like a male, which I couldn't tell whether it was Hispanic or black, wearing dark clothing and some kind of hat, wool hat.
Well, I think before you said Mr. Diallo resembled the rapist somewhat.
I said because of his height and approximate weight. There was a...
Shut the hell up, you pig, Sean Carroll. Talking about you couldn't make out whether Diallo was black or Latino, yet you had a composite of the serial rapist as being black. But I guess it just doesn't matter, right? In other words, you're in the Bronx, so hey, shoot them up all the undesirables. That's the way it goes. Now, this is taking the right-wing colorblindness to a whole nother perspective, right? Black, Latino, here's a bullet. See ya. Then you have the nerve to yap about, I seen the muzzle flash. I seen the muzzle flash. Yeah, fool, you did. It was you and your friend's muzzle blast. 41 times, as a matter of fact. And then you have the nerve to talk about where's the gun and all of that. You saw it, but then it turned out to be a wallet. You got it mixed up, fool. You must admit, where are the bullets that you left in Diallo's body and all scattered throughout the wall and everything else? After all, anyone who has the whole slogan, we own the night and hunting humans is fun, is just another pig. It's slavable time. You listen to 104.1. 93.7, 96.3, Slave Revolt Radio Time. Tonight, we have the Making It Plain news update, which will go into some aspects of cover-up and corruption, you know, cop style. and what some of these fools are up to on Wall Street. Then I'm a blast into a commentary on the cover-up, corruption, and the cops. Then top it off with a shameless file on this fool DA, Gil Garcetti. You know, the state district attorney head henchman down there, who of course is making every excuse imaginable for his pigs running amok. So we have all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt Radio.
Red cinder walls, broken down elevators, urine stench in the halls. Yoked, an oppression's membrane, four locks and three chains to bar them out. Or to bar me in. Not my village, with no community of self, raping, shooting, killing, all for personal wealth. For a little blow off the pipe, we lined massive pockets, bought and sold on Wall Street with bonds of stock market. This is not my nation, where riots burn in the streets, where killers are disguised as officers of peace. Could you look downtown, shouting, no justice, no peace? How about for food, or for shoes for your kids' feet? Oh, man, my fault. That's reserved for NBA repeats. This is certainly not my language, not my clothing, nor my customs, and this is definitely not my God, with singularity of sex and an image unholy. My name. What is an African American? The term makes no sense to me. No more than a dog cat. Being thin, fat, or a free man bound in slavery. This is not my home. Stooped over a heat grain. In a database, eating dinner off a license plate, SJ71968, as if you gave a damn. This is not my village, with the air brown, black, and gray, where mothers, fathers, and children say, at least 10 million. Brother, on you stand for change, I get something to eat. Or sister, would you help me get on my feet? This is not my nation. There is no love for life, no rhythm with life, no cycle in life. No tree of life, just people out of sync with a nation. away stolen too. This is not home. I am still an African in exile. No, wait. Just African, period. No hyphens, no apologies, no appendages. I am an African, and this is not my home. My home is in Africa. My village is in Africa. My nation is simply Africa. I am an African, and this is not my home. Africa, the spirit of my being, seeking knowledge of me, but finding knowledge of we, embracing our ancestral family.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Yeah, this is Tracy James with the Making It Plain News update. Gerald's in New York working on some Mumia stuff for our slave revolt aspects and, you know, stuff like that. So he'll be back next week to kick off the Making It Plain. So in the meantime, let's see what we got on Sam's plantation. And what we see beyond Sam's plantation is Latin America, and how Cuba plays the good doctor. Nieves Dorina graduated from high school in Nicaragua with good grades and had no prospects since her father, a farmer, had no money to send her to college. She figured marriage and motherhood were her only options. Quote, like many of my friends there, I thought I would take the 9 months career, unquote, she said. Quote, it does not cost anything, just 9 months. Easy, no? Unquote. But rather than having babies, Miss Dorina is now learning how to deliver them. She's among 1,900 students at the Latin American School of Medical Sciences who are enrolled in a 6-year program that is unique and has a unique twist on the old concept of overseas medical schools. While many people think a Caribbean campus is the last-ditch resort for foreign students with fat wallets but slim grades, this one is the exact opposite, giving full scholarships to smart young people from poor rural areas in 18 Latin American and Caribbean countries. The medical school is the Cuban government's response to the devastation from Hurricane George and Mitch, which ripped through the region in 1998, killing thousands as they destroyed villages and spawned public health problems. While Cuba sent medical teams to help, officials realized that it would be better in the long run to help educate a new generation of doctors who would return to their impoverished countries and work in remote communities with medical care, and where medical care was spotty and expensive. Quote, life has shown us some lessons that we cannot forget, said Juan Carras Estevez, the school's rector. This is the necessity of the right to health care that these countries have. We have a responsibility that these students return to their own countries with a solid foundation for dealing with the problems of public health they will find, unquote. Now, this is kind of interesting, especially when you look at the whole madness going on with a 7-year-old little kid, where these hoodlums over here are trying to Shanghai him and talk about the barbarity of Cuba and how Cuba has nothing to offer. But if you look around Latin America and compare it to Cuba, it's obvious who's the cream of the crop in Latin America. And you also notice one other thing. They're the one nation that has not yet bowed down to Sam's goals and aspirations. So what else we have blasting off is this little news report on it's like guarding, it's like the fox guarding the hen house. And this goes into the corrupt cop-turned-snitch, Rafael Perez, scoffs at the notion that the L.A. Police Department can be trusted to investigate itself. Quote, how are you going to have LAPD investigate? You know, it's like the fox guarding the hen house, unquote. Perez told a task force probing the largest LAPD corruption scandal in at least 50 years. Quote, you can't have the LAPD investigating the LAPD, unquote, the former elite Rampart crash officer said. There's too many relationships, too many friends, too many connections. Perez's words contained in reams of confidential testimony obtained by the Daily News echoes the intense cries coming from many civil rights leaders and criminal experts who want an independent commission established to probe the LAPD's alleged orgy of corruption. Needless to say, some of this aspects is right out of the LA Times. Seeking leniency on charges of stealing 8 pounds of cocaine from a police evidence room, Perez has testified that he and other officers in the Rampart Division Crash Anti-Gang Unit, Community Resource Against Street Hoodlums, shot innocent people, planted guns and narcotics on their victims, and routinely fabricated police reports and committed perjury in court. At least 57 cases involving 99 defendants have been confirmed by investigators who have been tainted by Perez and dozens of officers implicated by a widening investigation. But as this article goes on, basically what they start to do is talk about, you can trust us, we can do a good job. I'm not going to go too deep into this right now because on the Shameless file, I'm going to have a whole lot to deal with concerning Gil Garcetti and other thugs who are trying to protect the state. But it's also interesting that since they're being forced to address it, they're coming up with various forms of making excuses for how they reap what they sowed, so to speak. This is by Sean Huber, and she says, quote, the shortstop bar sits in a low brick storefront far from what people picture when you say a bar is on Sunset Boulevard. This is the Dodger Stadium Inn, the Immigrant Inn, the inn where the palm trees are tattered and the stucco is rust streaked. The inn is which L.A. remains forever as it was. Inside, past the narrow entrance and the shadows bar stools, what you notice are all the rules. Quote, no ID, no entry. Do not hang around outside after hours. Have one too few, not too many. They are posted on sheets of paper hanging like stations of the cross, like caution signs on a treacherous blacktop, like prayers, lead us not into temptation. She babbles on more and more. But it gets to the point where the bartender, a middle-aged woman in a Dodgers shirt, is angry. She is sick of the whole matter, the scandal, the newspaper, the politics, the looky-loos. The shortstop is a cop bar. So here we go. For 5 months now, since the Rampart scandal broke, one regular after another has been confined to home or run to the ground by internal affairs people. She snarls, spotting a notebook. You guys have dragged our name in shit long enough. So in other words, what she's saying is that since you exposed my fellow friends, the cops, you guys are at fault. Well, actually, the media really hasn't exposed them. But anyway, but then she relents. Rampart is, after all, a police-led investigation. The sickening revelations, the frame-ups, the dope dealing, the tales of brutality verging on murder. Actually, there was murder. Have come from the mouths of police. She says the one doing the most talking, Ray Perez, who, yes, came by the bar sometimes, but not like they say, is an aberration, the lone nut theory. She says maybe he's singing because one of his ex-partners is doing time for bank robbery, and there's, quote, $700,000 out there waiting for whoever gets out of jail first, unquote. Most of all, though, she wants to talk about tough-on-crime drumbeats that landed the weakest among her patrons in this pit of shame. Quote, let me tell you something, she finally burst out, lighting a Camel Red in violation of the city's no-smoking ordinance. I don't care if they have to hit some Chewy upside the head to stop crime in this city. And the public doesn't matter either. You think LAPD is the only department with the little secret tattoos? What's going on here is no mystery. We've always stepped on one's toes and stepped over the line to put the a-holes in jail, unquote. Well, you can get an idea of some of the mentality of the people out in good old L.A. and why this problem is far from over. Also, what we have in the news is in Florida, another death row is delayed. Florida's new rules streamlining and speeding the appeals process for death row inmates were suspended by the state Supreme Court until at least June 30th, citing numerous legal challenges. The seven-judge panel decided to go back to procedures used before the law passages last month. The appeals process changes were adopted with a bill allowing death row inmates to choose executions by injections or the electric chair. The court's decision does not affect the law allowing the choice. Now, we got a lot more for you, especially concerning the whole Shameless violence stuff. So that's it for the Make Me Play news update. Hold on, be right back. Thank you.
To me, I think what's happening is the picture is just race is the issue of race in law enforcement. It's always been there, but I think the people that are now heading the law enforcement departments are less sensitive to race now. For example, Janet Reno is our head in the U.S. Department of Justice, and we have written Janet Reno. We've written her letters. We've told her that there's a clear impact, disparate impact of treatment when it came down to African Americans in the agency, as well as Hispanics. Just to give you an example, in New York here, the white officers were shooting at a picture of Dr. Martin Luther King on a gun range. To me, that sends the message right there in a nutshell, if you want to say, that they just don't care. They really don't care about relations and race relations. We have just recently had a gun planted in a federal courthouse near a prisoner to set up Steve Zanowicz. There was a gun placed in the courthouse near a vehicle. He was escorting a prisoner. He comes to his vehicle, and basically there is a gun there. He reported this. There was no investigation done. This happened several months ago, and this was right at the height of his discrimination charges and complaints in the agency. So these are the types of things. What we're saying it's getting to the point now. It's very blatant. It's something serious is getting ready to occur.
I am. It's appalling what happened to Abner Valema, but I can truly say that I am not surprised, because these incidents occur across this nation every day of the year. In fact, as we speak, I'm sure some are occurring now. As an agent with the FBI, I was assigned at one time to look into civil rights matters, and I took several cases to the people in charge of the FBI headquarters. And on those occasions, they specifically told me that they weren't interested in civil rights matters, never have been, weren't now, and never would be. And they would only look into these matters in the case where they were pressured by the media or by public pressure. They said they had to establish a relationship with local police departments, with the National Academy, which is the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, where the FBI bring in police officers from around the nation to create this kind of camaraderie. In fact, it was created by Hoover to do just that, to join local police with federal police. And the supervisor at headquarters specifically told me that they would find it difficult to investigate police officers in brutality cases. And so the cases continue. And as I mentioned and talked about last year and documented in Primetime Live, covered and did an independent investigation in Detroit, where Myles Green was beaten to death by two police officers, the FBI, just as they are doing in New York, opened a civil rights investigation. And then at the same time, they had the civil rights investigation going on in the FBI office. FBI agents were holding a fundraiser to pay for the defense of the police officers. So you have the FBI investigating, heading towards prosecution of the police officers, and at the same time raising money for their defense with flyers blatantly placed around the office. And you had members of the media come in to see these flyers, and they didn't care anything about it, because this is the way the system has worked, and this is the way it continues to work. The numbers indicate that. 1996, 11,721 complaints, civil rights complaints, most of them police brutality complaints. 2,000 of them are referred. Of the 11,000, 2,000 are referred to prosecution, and less than 79 go to court. Out of 11,000 cases, 79 cases, most of them police brutality cases, end up in court, and many of them, only 2% of them, you end up with convictions. And I think what's important is that, and this can be verified, at the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, they have a behavior science unit. And in that unit, profiles come out of that unit. During the time that I was an agent, profiles came out of that unit, and they actually profile African Americans in this country as a very emotional people. And the response to that, the strategic response out of the behavioral science unit, was that when issues come up like this, the beating of Abner Valema and other, the Myles Green case, that you respond to it in a fashion with press conferences, you create committees and task forces, and eventually it'll go away. The people will move on to another topic. Whereas if you had a scientific scientific response, then there would be no quitting on the issue until you came to some kind of logical conclusion. Everything would be checked out. But they realized that an immediate response of creating task force, of saying the FBI are involved in this case, even with the statistics to show that nothing will probably be done, the immediate response will calm the public fears and send them on to other issues, and then in the end, nothing will be done about the case. And this is not me saying this. This is an FBI profile of what will happen in these major cases, and it comes from the Behavioral Science Unit at Quantico, Virginia, where they're individuals paid to handle what is to determine what will happen and what is the best response to incidents like this. And I'm sure over the last couple of weeks, numerous reports have come out. And the reality of the matter is, in more cases than not, they're not. We'll write about it early on. We'll talk about it on the radio. We'll talk about it on television. And then 6 months from now, we're on to another issue, and the matter hasn't been resolved. And so the thing keeps going on over and over and over again throughout the nation.
Into a commentary on the sound of the police, cover up and corruption style. Hold on.
That's the sound that I'm
cover-up, corruption, and the cops. The lone nut theory, or an American tradition. When the fallout over the Watergate-like Furman tapes took place, once again, the corporate-owned media, the cops, and the American politicians began painting Mark DeFuhrer Furman as a rogue or lone nut cop. This is the usual tactic by these prophets of deceit, and it's a lie. The role of the police has been, since its birth, a repressively violent institution whose role is to enforce by any means the laws of a ruling elite class and to protect the property of the state's ruling class. Now, this ruling elite class, which has enslaved Africans, obliterated the Indians, supported and financed the Nazis, slaughtered millions of Vietnamese in Southeast Asia, and has done atomic radiation experiments on its own population in America, is in no position to rate or classify anyone else's conduct, lone nut or otherwise. But I'll let you be the judge. Philadelphia Inquirer, August 27, 1995. 5 murder cases may be tossed out. Now comes the murder cases. In the ever-widening wake of the 39th District Police corruption scandal, Philadelphia judges have thrown out 42 drug convictions and may throw out hundreds more. Now defense lawyers say the taint has spread to 5 murder cases. Cops who today admit that they were crooked played a role in bringing charges in all 5 North Philadelphia slayings. One former officer's longtime snitch said she was secretly paid $500 to testify about a 1986 ballroom killing. In 2 other murder investigations, another crooked cop said drugs had been planted to justify illegal searches. Evidence from those searches was used in court. Now, this all started out when a black grandmother, Betty Patterson, who after spending 3 years in prison was set free after her innocence was revealed by investigators who uncovered the fact that the police had framed up the black grandmother by planting drugs into her home. Over 50 drug convictions had been overturned since her release due to perjured testimony or police planted evidence. Quote, "It keeps hemorrhaging," unquote, said Bradley Bridge, a local public defender. A grand jury is investigating over 100,000 other arrests. Quote, "What's most disturbing about the Philadelphia corruption," unquote, noted legal scholar Lynn Washington, is, quote, "the DA knew what the cops were up to but tolerated their use of planted evidence because it boosted their conviction rates," unquote. In February of 95, other gangster cops were indicted on federal charges for conspiracy, obstruction of true justice, illegal searches, intimidation, theft of more than $100,000 in cash, and denying suspects their constitutional rights. Now this is the land of the, never mind, lone nut, or an American tradition. In New Orleans, 32-year-old Kim Groves was looking out her window when she saw 2 thugs in blue beating and pistol whipping up in their proud tradition of Rodney King, a black teenager. Kim recognized one of the lowlifes as Officer Lynn Davis. He was an instructor in a safety course she had taken a little while back. Little did Kim know that she would need safety from this cop. She filed a brutality complaint against the cops. Davis, who was already being wiretapped by phone by the feds for trafficking drugs, was reported giving Kim's description to his fellow friends in crime as Kim was standing outside her home. 20 minutes later, Davis received a call back from those who are supposed to serve and protect. Well, their mission was served and fulfilled. They shot Kim Groves, mother of 2, twice in the head. Quote, "Yeah, rock-rockabye," unquote, was Davis's cheerful declaration of independence. Independence of Kim's life and brutality complaint, that is. all recorded by accident by the FBI. In the past few years in New Orleans, headline scandals of the scandalous police have been rocking the Mardi Gras. Cops have been charged with armed robbery, kidnapping, battery, bribery, extortion, rape, and murder. And what has been ranked one of the most brutal police departments in the county, Officer Antoinette Frank was found guilty robbing a restaurant and murdering three persons in the process. Lone Nut, or an American tradition. In Chicago, they have their own Frankenstein, Mr. John Burge, who was trotting around torturing suspects and inmates with a homemade or cooked up electrode set with a self-made generator with wire clips that he would attach to your ears and genitals, crank up the generator, and watch you fry. It got so bad that Amnesty International listed it as one of the worst human rights abuses in the world. Now, in New York, the Mullen Commission brought out, amongst other things, that in the Bronx's 48th precincts, the cops led by head Rambo cop Richard Rivera were busy getting drunk on duty, taking drugs, and plotting their next line of robberies and graft until May 3rd of 95, when 16 cops were arrested and indicted for an equal opportunity number of charges ranging from stealing weapons and money to illegally raiding apartments to falsifying evidence. But not to be outdone or outfinanced, cop Michael Comenzas kept $1 million cash in his locker for his Cali drug cartel drug laundering, money laundering operation, according to federal investigators. Now, down the road to the 75th precinct in Brooklyn, Michael Dow and five other police drug dealers were arrested for cocaine trafficking in Suffolk County, Long Island. Dow, who often rode around in a new red Corvette, also had limos pick him up at the police station and chauffeur him to Atlanta City to gamble. And he never had any of his citizen-style complaints investigated. So from the morgue boy cops from Brownsville's 73rd precinct, who when they weren't robbing or shooting citizens, they were, according to the Mullen Commission report, drinking and snorting cocaine on duty, meeting with their girlfriends and or prostitutes, and shooting off their guns, to one precinct in New York, which had to be closed down completely because the cops got caught selling crack out of the precinct. Lone Nut, or an American tradition. But the vicious institutionalized nature of the police has its origins embedded in America's barbaric history. Organized police forces and white supremacist organizations have their origins in approximately the same period, the Civil War years. The government during that period did not wield the power it wields today. The slave codes were enforced by the slave owners and their overseers, who would deputize slave patrols, i.e. cop patrols, from amongst the white male population. But after the conquest of Mexico, the abolition of slavery, and the destruction of the native populations throughout North America, along with America's growing industrializations, more modern forms of controlling the American society and its people within it came into being. The Klan sprang out to re-disenfranchise the newly freed slaves during the Reconstruction period to restore the old slaveocracy. It was during that time throughout the country that a permanent armed band of professional law enforcement groupings began to develop. The police departments were set up after the British model of constables on patrol, or cops, who were designed to maintain the existing order and to enforce the property relations of the elite class. Now, to maintain these racist, sexist, and at times genocidal institutions, you must attract people who have accepted and swallowed the indoctrination of this racist system and who will work as enforcers, i.e. cops, for it, which is suspiciously similar to the Klan and other white supremacist groupings like MAO, Men Against Women, and WASP, White Anglo-Saxon Policemen, in San Diego, 1980. A cop assigned to the Ku Klux Klan provides funds and radio equipment and also helps gather ballot signatures for all-American Aryan man Tom Metzger. During his run for Congress, old Metzger won the Democratic elections but lost the general elections. In San Bernardino, California, 1989, black cops seeking a promotion are themselves sought out by the Brotherhood of Aryan Resistance, a white supremacist cop group. The cop finds threatening letters in a secure area in the police locker room in L.A. After two cops are suspended for practicing a traditional American pastime, burning a cross, and in this case, inside a jail facility, one of the cops, Brian Comiskey, later shoots and kills a Mexican national. Later it's revealed that in the police's Peter Pitch jail facility, there's this white supremacist cop group called the Wayside Whiteys. In East L.A., there's the Caveman. And at the Linwood station, you have the group of American Nazi Christian patriots called the Vikings. And in Florida, 92, David Demiski, who was fired from the police for flaunting a swastika tattoo at a Jewish female cop's, seeks reinstatement with the honest statement that racism and Nazism are rampant on the police force. For proof, he provides a picture of two fellow cops dressed in a Nazi uniform that was in the chief of police's office. There's probably one in Crime Bill Clinton's Oval Office in the White House. Lone Nut or an American tradition? I'll let you be the judge. This is Tracy James with a commentary. Cover up corruption in the cops. The Lone Nut theory or just a good old American tradition?